Welcome to audio highlights of an ASCO Satellite Symposium, a live think tank on clinical controversies and promising therapeutic strategies in management of non-small cell lung cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Along with co-chair Dr. Tom Lynch, we gathered a panel of clinical investigators, Dr. Jean-Charles Soria, Dr. Chandra Balani, Dr. Vince Miller, and Dr. Mark Sosinski, to discuss and debate these issues. We began by considering adjuvant systemic therapy, and I asked my co-chair, Dr. Lynch, what he says to patients with stage 2B disease with a tumor under 4 centimeters about whether adjuvant chemo offers a benefit, and if so, how much.
This is something I struggle with a lot. I think back to the time when we weren't treating node-negative breast cancer. Now, looking in this group, I don't see a lot of gray hair, but there are probably some of you who were practicing back before we treated node-negative breast cancer, and it was a similar sense in the concept of proportional risk reduction. If you believe the concept of proportional risk reduction, which I think we believe very strongly in breast cancer, somewhat strongly in colorectal cancer, and I suspect is not ridiculous to think it may be happening in lung cancer as well, would argue that there may still be a small benefit, and one of the meta-analysis, 70 to 73% or 70 to 71% for some of these smaller tumors. So what I tend to do is for the patients who are marginal, meaning the patients who've got a 2.5 to 4 centimeter tumor, I do discuss a very small but potentially real benefit in that setting, and it becomes a difficult discussion.
Vince, what about the approach, the values in lung cancer patients in the adjuvant setting compared to breast cancer? People have this vision that breast cancer patients are very proactive. Lung cancer patients are older. Maybe they have more comorbidities. But is there a subset of patients, as Tom just described, of people who want any benefit, who will go through chemo for, you know, a modest improvement?
Well, remember the median age of our lung cancer patients is 70-ish. So they're a decade or two older chronologically than the breast cancer patients, and physiologically often far greater than that. So I do think they approach the decision-making with a somewhat different mindset than many breast cancer patients might. But we certainly, because it's such a common disease, have innumerable patients in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and even 20s sometimes. And there, the decision-making process, I think, should be more aggressive and hopefully based on some biomarker-driven strategies in the not-too-distant future.
Let's talk a little bit about the choice of therapy, and I'll ask Mark to talk about the way you approach it.
I do agree that if you were writing an evidence-based guideline, that the evidence is the strongest with cisplatin and vinorelbine. It's a difficult regimen to administer in the adjuvant setting. We also know in stage four that cisvinorelbine may not be the optimal regimen. We are now in the world of histologies, and you know, I think that ECOG 1505 allows us four different choices. Certainly the evidence-based choice of cisvinorelbine, but extrapolating from stage 4 disease, cisplatinum docetaxel, cisplatinum gemcitabine, and cisplatinum pemetrexed. Now, do you really think we have to test every platinum-based doublet in the adjuvant setting against a no-treatment control arm or against the standard of cisvinorelbine to show? I don't think we want to use our resources asking that question. We've already advanced beyond that, and we're asking questions of anti-angiogenic therapy, anti-EGFR therapy. We're trying to do biomarkers to identify patients that may have differential benefits. So I think, even though there's not direct evidence, I think the paradigm that the Eastern Cooperative Group has set that says that these are four reasonable regimens. I've never had anybody disagree with those choices of four regimens as reasonable strategies in this disease setting.
And of course, you're talking about the trial looking at bevacizumab
right
in the adjuvant setting. Chandra, what about, and Tom challenges us in one of the comments here, that, quote, the faculty stands up here and says they never use carbo in the adjuvant setting, and then they get a 70-year-old patient or whatever and use it. What about that?
I think the premise is that there is a benefit of adjuvant therapy. And I think that if the patient is not able to tolerate cisplatin, though cisplatin would be the regimen of choice in the adjuvant setting because you get that extra advantage in terms of overall survival. But I don't see anything wrong in using carboplatin-based regimens in a patient who's 70 years old or who has a compromise in renal function. And we do it all the time, and most of you do it all the time. Somebody asked the question that cisplatin pemetrexed is not part of 1505, but it has been added as part of 1505 for patients with non-squamous cell lung cancer.
Tom, just as long as we mention that issue, and I mentioned in my comment that it seems like a long time ago, it was just a year ago that Norm Wallmark presented the adjuvant Bev colon study, which was, quote, negative, although there was a drop in relapse rate while they got the Bev. How does that affect the way you look at this lung study?
I tend to be pretty enthusiastic with the lung study because I think it's the first time it's accruing well, slower than we'd like, but it's accruing well. It will be the first large adjuvant study done in the U.S. And I think there's a lot of benefit to seeing a large adjuvant study done in the U.S. And I think that bevacizumab is as reasonable an option of any to see how it performs in this setting. There are differences between different diseases in terms of benefits from bevacizumab. And while my enthusiasm is a bit tempered from the colorectal experience, it certainly doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile to look at this in lung.
Final comment from Jean-Charles. Where do you think we're heading in terms of the whole area of tissue biomarkers in prediction of or which therapy to choose in the adjuvant setting? Again, thinking about breast cancer, we see the Oncotype DX genomic assay, RT-PCR. Now it's being looked at in colon cancer, being presented here in renal cell cancer, very interestingly. What about genomic predictors and other tissue predictors in terms of adjuvant therapy in non-small cell? Jean-Charles?
We have three signatures, at least from a transcriptional point of view, the metagene signature, and then there is a 5-gene signature and 10-gene signatures. These are prognostic markers, and they tend to suggest that you should treat those with the worst prognosis. That's not totally clear if it is the way to go. The other approach is try to sort out individual gene candidates or multiple gene candidate scores. And I think we will move towards the same direction as the Oncotype DX in breast. And there are now scores of multiple DNA repair. There is a company called OncoET, for instance, which is doing a DNA repair score with MSH2, ERCC1, PARP, and so on. So I think this field is going to move ahead quite rapidly.
And certainly, in many ways, this field's ahead of other fields, including breast cancer, in terms of what's been seen with EGFR mutations. Tom, I was telling you that Tony Greco has a case that I've seen sent in to me that he's going to present in a program we're doing where, in an adjuvant setting, a patient who's resected, somehow he sent the tumor for both not only EGFR, a non-smoking patient, not only EGFR mutations, but EML4-ALK. And, you know, I think docs in practice are used to seeing ER and HER2 and KRAS and their colon and breast. Do you think that that is going to become routine in the resected specimen, Tom?
Yes, I do. And I think that one of the doctors made a comment about extrapolating from stage 4 to stage 1. And I agree with you. We do need studies to verify this to the clinician who raised that. But I do think given some of the breakthroughs we're seeing in these oncogene-addicted diseases like EGFR mutated and EML4-ALK, I do think if I had a patient with one of those abnormalities, I think it becomes something that needs to be studied and not only studied but actively considered as options for these patients.
Of course, in the adjuvant setting, it'd be kind of interesting to do that with EML4-ALK, but maybe in a couple of years.